You are listening to Middle East Monitor Conversations, bringing you lively discussions with prominent voices from the region and beyond, as we delve deeper into issues shaping the Middle East and North Africa, from politics to culture and the arts.
Hello and welcome to another conversation with the Middle East Monitor. With me, Nasim Ahmed, I will be your host for today's conversation. And I'm thrilled to be joined today with a leading expert on Iran-US relations, Dr. Trita Parsi. Trita is an award-winning author. He's an expert on US-Iran relations, Iranian foreign policy, and the geopolitics of the Middle East. He's authored three books on US foreign policy in the Middle East, with a particular focus on Iran and Israel. And I've been really enjoying listening to his analysis over the past few weeks, his amazing analysis. And I thought, you know, it really benefit our viewers, and I'm thrilled to have him on our show today. So thank you, Trita, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
I mean, let's dive in with a tough question here. I mean, how dangerous is this moment that we're in currently? It's been compared to the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Is that really the case? On the other hand, we know no one really wants a war. The US does not want to escalate this. The Iranians don't want to escalate this. The regional actors in the Gulf countries don't want to escalate this. The only person that would have liked to escalate this is Benjamin Netanyahu. But that said, you know, situations like this can spiral out of control. So within the context of history, how dangerous is this moment?
It's still a very dangerous moment. The Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, risks a nuclear war. So we're not at that level, but we're certainly at the level of a major regional war. Temporarily, the risk has come down because at the end of the day, both sides chose to de-escalate, and the United States in the background also worked to defuse at least this chapter of the crisis. But when you take a look at it from a larger picture, I think we have to be fair and say the Biden administration deserves some credit for helping defuse the crisis this time around. But it is also Biden's own policies that has put us on the trajectory in which we are at the precipice of this crisis. And that precipice, that trajectory has not changed. We're still in a very dangerous moment. It can blow up soon again. In some ways, unless this trajectory changes, which necessitates a change in policy on the US side as well, we're going to continue to be on a path in which every once in a while we're going to be at moments like this. And we simply cannot count on getting lucky every time. It was skills and luck that prevented this escalation this time around. We cannot count on that working every time going forward. And by the way, on your comments, I think you're quite right. The United States doesn't want to have this conflict. The Iranians certainly don't want it. And it's not just, however, Netanyahu in the Israeli cabinet that wants it. He certainly does want it. An enlargement and a prolonging of the war is necessary from his standpoint, because the minute it ends, his political career ends and potentially his prison sentence begins. So prolonging the war, enlarging the war, is something that he certainly has an interest in. But also other hardline elements in his cabinet are of the same view, and perhaps even more hawkish. You did have Ben-Gvir, the Minister of National Security, tweet and essentially lambast the Israeli response to Iran by calling it lame on Twitter, which is quite unprecedented, of course, that a sitting minister criticizes the decision of the cabinet that he is a member of in this matter on national security issues. But it tells you quite clearly there were other members of the cabinet that would have preferred to go much, much stronger against Iran in that second attack by the Israelis.
And thankfully, it hasn't escalated so far, as you mentioned. But Israel did retaliate on Friday in a very small way. But looking back over the past 9 days since the Iranian strike, you spoke about Biden. How would you rate his administration in their efforts to prevent it escalating and spiraling out of control? You wrote an article in the New York Times, and I thought it was really interesting. We'll get to the second part of that, but you start off by saying Biden should be praised. So what has the Biden administration done behind the scene to make sure this does not, you know, go out of control?
Well, overall, I would probably give the Biden administration a D or an F, because the strategic trajectory at the end of the day is what's most important. But when it comes to this specific episode, the Biden administration helped manage a choreography of an Iranian response to the Israeli attack and then tried to stop the Israelis from responding at all. But what ended up happening is that, as usual, Netanyahu didn't listen to Biden, but nevertheless went with an attack that was much more limited than what other Israeli members of his cabinet wanted to and what the U.S. feared Israel might do. So in that sense, it is very helpful and praiseworthy that the administration used some of its leverage to change what Netanyahu's plans were. But if you even, before going into the strategic level, even at the tactical level, I still have significant criticisms of how the Biden administration has handled this. First of all, the Israelis did not give the United States any heads up or meaningful heads up. They essentially told the United States about the attack on Damascus, where they hit the Iranian consular section of the embassy on April 1st. They told them about it only moments before the missiles actually hit. This infuriated the Pentagon and the Biden administration, because this was clearly a major escalation designed, arguably, to escalate matters with Iran, potentially bring in the U.S. into the war. And even at its minimum stage, it risked ending the truce that existed between the United States and the Iraqi and Syrian militias, which would then see them start attacking U.S. troops and bases in the region once more. And as you remember, three Americans were killed not too long ago by these militias. So the U.S. was infuriated by this, but the question is, what were the consequences for Israel having done this? What was the price Israel paid for having done something that directly endangered U.S. national security and the lives of American troops? I cannot point to anything that the Biden administration did in order to reprimand the Israelis for doing something so risky and reckless. Instead, you had the Biden administration come in, defend Israel by shooting down a lot of those different attacks, etc., which, again, I'm perfectly fine with, because it seemed to have been designed to de-escalate. But the question is, to what extent will we actually exit the situation in which the Israelis will no longer try to escalate matters if the United States and the Biden administration doesn't exact a cost, a price on Netanyahu when he does escalate against the wishes of the United States? So if from the very outset the Biden administration had taken an approach in which they didn't treat the Israeli government with kid's gloves, then we wouldn't be in this situation in the first place. We should not be on the precipice of war. Those three American soldiers should not have been killed. And of course, 34,000 innocent Palestinians should not have been killed either. So again, great that the worst outcome of this strategy was avoided, but the strategy itself is bringing us towards a major confrontation. And unless Biden changes that strategy, he's not going to get a better grade from me.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, so who do you blame? Because despite the fact that the Biden administration has managed to prevent a further escalation, it has escalated. It's to the point that Iran retaliated to the Israeli assault on its embassy. And of course, the Houthis have escalated their attack, and Hezbollah as well. So in many ways, Biden has failed. So I would assume, you know, you would blame the Americans totally for the fact that it's their decision and it's their policy which has, you know, allowed this to spiral out of control to some extent.
I will give a significant share of the blame to the Biden administration, because Biden has been arming, funding the Israeli war effort, despite the fact that Biden himself has said that the Israelis are indiscriminately bombing Gaza. Biden has circumvented Congress twice in getting arms and weapons to Israel faster and not allowing Congress to be able to weigh in on it. And this is done knowing quite well that the Israelis are using 2,000-pound bombs that are supposed to be used against bunkers. They're using them against apartment buildings, killing everything within a 300-yard radius. That is the very definition of indiscriminate bombings. the US is well aware that the AI that the Israelis are using is such that it actually targets very, very low level suspected Hamas officials, not when they're out in Gaza, but when they're actually at home sleeping at night in the apartments with their children, including everyone else in that same apartment building and on that block that will also be killed based on a suspicion that this very low-level person may actually have something to do with Hamas. Biden has done nothing to put a stop to this. On top of that, he has blocked three UN resolutions that demanded either a ceasefire or a humanitarian pause. The fourth one that he allowed to pass, he turned around immediately and undermined by falsely claiming that it was not legally binding. On top of that, we also saw that the Biden administration used the fourth veto to prevent the recognition and the membership of the Palestinians into the UN as a full member state, showing that at least for the last two decades, the United States has not been serious about the two-state process, the peace process actually leading to a two-state solution and a Palestinian state. Whether that was the intent from the beginning or not is perhaps unclear, but at a minimum, one can say that for the last two decades, the U.S. has not been serious about it, and when given the opportunity to make it happen, actually use the veto in order to do so. So I think there's plenty of blame that needs to go to the Biden administration for allowing the situation to escalate to this point. And let me add another thing. When it comes to the ceasefire, the reason why that is so important is not just because of the need to prevent the slaughter of Palestinians who have nothing to do with Hamas. It's also because the slaughter itself is fueling tensions throughout the region, including the attacks by the Houthis, including the attacks by the Iraqi and the Syrian militias. And that then leads to an escalation risk in the region as a whole, in which the United States itself could be get dragged in to a major war. This is almost what happened, of course, when the Israelis attacked the embassy. I am stunned by the acceptance that Biden has showed for this escalation risk. His first and foremost responsibility is to keep America safe and keep America out of unnecessary wars in the Middle East that do not serve U.S. interests. The amount of risk that he has accepted here that can actually bring the United States into an unnecessary war in the Middle East that does not serve U.S. interests is astounding to me.
Which is why I found your the last veto really shocking, the one on Palestinian statehood, recognition of Palestinian statehood, membership of the UN, because that would have demonstrated US good faith in recognizing a Palestinian state. Not only that, I mean, their strategic goal is for the Abraham Accords to come to fruition. And one of the conditions is Palestinian statehood. And the fact that the US consistent vetoes that, again, undermines its position and its commitment to this two-state solution. So that really surprised me. I wanted to move on to, I wanted to ask you about the Iranian response itself. Previously, Iranian assets have been hit by Israelis, but Tehran did not strike back in the manner it has it did to 9 days ago. Presumably, Iran's non-retaliation against Israel in the past gave Israel a license, it felt, to be able to strike Iran without expecting a retaliation. So do you think there was a major miscalculation then on the part of Tel Aviv this time, thinking they could get away with it like they did before after they assassinated Iranian scientists, for example, and various other scientists and Iranian assets that were hit in Damascus and other places?
Absolutely. This was a huge strategic error by the Israelis. Let me break it down in its components. First of all, you're quite right. The Iranians have taken a lot of hits by the Israelis and have justified that by saying that they're playing the long game, strategic patience, they know time is on their side, in the sense that Iran has been building up these different partner organizations from Hezbollah to the militias in Iraq and Syria to Houthis, and given them technology that they didn't have 10, 15 years ago. If you take a look at the war in 2006, for instance, and how Hezbollah fought Israel back then. Of course, it was a war that most analysts would say ultimately Hezbollah won by virtue of not losing. But drones were not a critical component in that war. Now they are, because the technological playing field has evened, and the Iranians have the ability to be able to use drones, to be able to use guided missiles, etc., in a manner that it couldn't before. And so the strategic patience has essentially been justified by saying that time is on their side, and as a result, they should not walk into the trap that the Israelis are putting for them by trying to have a confrontation sooner rather than later. So, but that long game can only work if you also have a short game. And the argument that was being used by hardliners in Israel was that the absence of any response by the Iranians, particularly when senior people had been killed already in Lebanon and Syria, had essentially emboldened the Israelis and enabled them to constantly push the envelope. And they would keep on pushing it and striking against Iran's more and more valuable assets and targets unless the Iranians did something to put a stop to it. The strike against the embassy ended up becoming the last straw, precisely because so much had already happened, but also then, of course, because the embassy is technically Iranian soil, which was a clear Iranian red line. Had the embassy attack happened 2 years ago, I'm not so sure the Iranians would have responded in the same manner. It would definitely have been a problem, would have been a violation of their red line, but I think it's the accumulation of so many different attacks, a turn in the debate inside of Tehran in which those arguing for some form of a response had grown stronger and stronger over time. Now, the reason I think this was a strategic mistake by the Israelis is not just because the Iranians responded, but because what the final outcome of all of this has been once the dust now has settled. If you take a look at some of the media narrative in the West, it seeks to give a lot of praise to Israel, saying that Israel won, Iran failed, you know, 99% of the rockets shot down, which has now been revised down to 84%. But nevertheless, this was not a success for the Iranians. This is part of the strategy that was used by the administration to try to convince the Israelis not to escalate further, stand down by essentially declaring them the winners, whether that's true or not. When you scratch the surface, I have a hard time coming to the conclusion that this was a net win for the Israelis. Because you see, when the Israelis then responded in kind after the Iranian response, they showed that they had the capacity to strike Iran. They showed that they had the capacity to fly drones from inside of Iran itself. They showed that their capacity of circumventing and penetrating the Iranian airspace and air defenses. None of that is new. There is no one in the Iranian defense establishment that didn't already know this. But when you take a look at what the Iranians did, I think there's quite a few surprises that came through. First of all, they gave them 72 hours heads up. Flew drones that were meant to be shot down because at the end of the day, they were meant to test and essentially distract the Israeli air defenses. The United States, France, Britain, and the Jordanians had enough time to scramble and be part of the Israeli defenses and helped shoot down the majority of the different projectiles that were shot down. Nevertheless, given all of that, the Iranians still managed to get 7 missiles through the air defenses that struck Israeli air bases, 3 of them, or military bases, 3 of them. That's new. What we didn't know before this is that the Iranians, even with 72 hours heads up, have the capacity of striking back at Israel successfully. This didn't exist before. So if you compare the world post-April 1 and pre-April 1, the Israelis did nothing that was surprising, revealed nothing that we didn't already know that they had, whereas the Iranians managed to reveal capacity that we suspected that they had, but now we have confirmation that they have. Moreover, it also became very clear that even when Israel is attacked, even though it was, of course, a response to Israel's own attack, the United States is so adamant about avoiding a larger war in the region that it will put pressure on Israel not to retaliate. Not the degree of pressure that I think is necessary, but nevertheless. All of these things, I think, has succeeded for the Iranians to establish a new equilibrium. I think the Israelis are going to be very careful about attacking Iran again, because they know that there's a price to pay, and they know that Iran has the capacity of inflicting significant damage on Israel. Of course, the Iranians already knew that the Israelis have a capacity to inflict even greater damage on Iran. But that's, again, not something new that was revealed here. That was already existing knowledge. There is now a new balance of terror in the region between Israel and Iran post-April 1 that is not as beneficial to Israel as it was before April 1. That is a strategic loss for the Israelis.
So what you're saying is that given the manner of Iran's response, there is a change in the rules of engagement between the two countries, and this rule of engagement presumably now favors Iran rather than Israel.
No, I don't think it favors Iran. I think what you have had for the Israelis is that since the defeat of Saddam Hussein in 1991, there has not been a single Arab army that could pose a conventional military threat to Israel. The Israelis defined their threats increasingly in that period as either being asymmetric terrorism or a potential future nuclear threat. Israel, as a result, had complete maneuverability and freedom of action in the region and could act with impunity. It's been regularly striking Lebanon. It's been regularly striking Syria. Even before that, you remember, they struck Tunis. And they've been able to do so and get away with it without any consequences. Now you have a new situation. They cannot do this against Iran or Iranian assets without getting away with it. It doesn't mean that the strategic picture has shifted entirely in Iran's favor. It means that a degree of an Israeli freedom of action that it had enjoyed for quite some time and probably could have enjoyed for a bit more longer has come to an end because of Israel's strategic mistake of striking that embassy.
And that strike, presumably Israel was expecting some form of strike, but not 320 aerial projectiles to be, you know, sent towards Israel. But do you think the manner of that strike, in the calculation of the Iranians, is that Israel is actually weak now? It's isolated globally. Of course, there's a genocide going on in Gaza. Regionally, the Arab countries did not seem, other than Jordan, did not seem to be did not rush to Israel's defense. And globally, of course, Israel has become a pariah. So I think, do you think part of the response or the size of the response is really a reflection of the fact that Iranians now think Israel is in a much, much weaker position than it was prior to 7 October?
I don't think that is the case. I think the Iranian response needed to be of this size in order for them to signal their seriousness and manage to make sure that out of this many projectiles, 300 or 320, at least a couple of them would be able to penetrate the air defenses. If they had done half of that, perhaps zero of these missiles would have been able to get through. They needed to make sure that they could get through, and that required a larger attack than I think Israeli and Western defense analysts expected the Iranians to pull off. But I also think it would be a huge mistake if the Iranians concluded from this that Israel is weak. Israel is not weak militarily. Israel is absolutely isolated internationally, and even though its support from the West is stronger than it was before, Israel is now almost returning to a pre-1991 level when it comes to its standing in the global South. And the global South, the global majority, is much more important now than it was back in 1990 by sheer amount of power that countries like India, South Africa, Brazil, etc. have. Israel's standing is at an absolute bottom in the rest of the world. And we can see that in the UN votes that have been taking place since October 7th. But militarily, Israel is still very strong. What has happened is not that Israel has turned weak militarily, it's that Israel has lost its air of invincibility and its air of complete defensibility. It is vulnerable. It is no longer invulnerable as it was before. That has changed. That is a very important strategic shift. But it is not necessarily so that it amounts to meaning that Israel is weak militarily and as a result, no match for the Iranians, for instance. And I'm not saying that that's what you suggested. I just want to clarify that. There is an era of invulnerability that is lost, but Israel is still very strong militarily.
Yeah, and that invulnerability, it was part of the mystique it created around itself. It defeated Arab armies in 6 days, and there was this myth of its deterrence capacity. But I think having defeated 5 Arab armies at one time, many would say you're not able to defeat a non-state actor in the form of Hamas in Gaza. And it's been 6 months and Hamas has not been fully defeated. And Israel has not been able to achieve its strategic goals in Gaza so far after 7 months of carrying out what many consider to be a genocide. So by that definition, many would say this vaunted deterrence capacity Israel developed over many, many years, that's definitely shattered to some extent.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. And I think what you're going to see is that the Israelis are going to spend a lot of time and resources and get a lot of money from the United States to try to reestablish that level of deterrence and invest in manners to strengthen their air defenses, etc. So this is a moment in which the two sides have managed to step into the ring for 30 seconds, feel each other out, but there wasn't a full match. And they're going to go back, practice, and try to figure out how they overcome their weaknesses and how they strengthen the advantages they have. So, and I mentioned this because there's nothing in the strategic picture that has changed that actually would say we're now moving towards real de-escalation, perhaps negotiations, perhaps a peace on the country. This is a small pause within a trajectory that is still pointing towards a confrontation at some point. I don't believe it is inevitable, as some people are saying, but we're still on the same trajectory as before.
One final question before we end, and I want to look ahead and ask you about the future consequences of the war in on Gaza. You mentioned that the Israelis did not inform their allies in Washington that they were striking the Iranian embassy. And America, Biden has done so much. He's paying for the war literally, bullets and bombs, and politically as well. If you look at all the polls, Biden is suffering. And there's a realization that the cost of supporting Israel is really high. And you see that on the marches in the US. There's a massive movement growing around ending US support of Israel, ending Israel's occupation of Israel. So the long-term consequences look bleak for Israel. So do you think this will have a huge impact going forward for future administrations and in their calculations of how much support they can offer Israel, given the heavy cost of providing that support?
There's many people in Washington who believe that Biden is likely the last transatlantic president of the United States, the type of a president that would invest as heavily in NATO, in the defense of Europe, what he has done in Ukraine, given very significant changes in the American populace on these issues. I would say that he's also likely the last president to provide this degree of, frankly, blind and unwarranted support for Israel, even when it comes at the expense of his re-election bid and many other things. And I can go and list those different things. The changes that are taking place amongst young people in America are formative. They are not temporary. The manner in which now an entire generation of young Americans, as well as we're talking about people up to their 50s, are viewing Israel as a state engaged in apartheid, view them as a state engaged in genocide, is not going to change easily. This is fundamentally going to have a profound impact on the politics of the United States going forward. We may not see it in the next couple of months. We may not see it in the next 5 to 10 years even. But if Israel is on this trajectory, then I don't think there is any capacity in which the various organizations in Washington who have worked hard to make sure that the U.S. and Israel are bound by to the hip on these different issues, that they will be able to ensure such a policy on the United States, given the very clear and growing opposition that exists. And it's not just on the left, by the way. It is also on the right in the United States. Take a look at what people like Tucker Carlson and others are saying. They too are divorcing themselves from the idea that a litmus test for being a patriotic American is to blindly support Israel, regardless of what it does.
Peter, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thoroughly enjoyed having you on Memo Conversation, and I hope you enjoy our conversation as well. And
absolutely.
Thank you for tuning. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This was Middle East Monitor Conversations, brought to you by the Middle East Monitor in London.